This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your hosts, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
And here we are again at another episode of On the Couch. My name is Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
And I'm Benny Massey, LPCC, and you are on the couch.
We are going to explore and provide information tonight about the different levels of care that you can receive within the mental health field. We want to encourage you to call in. Our number is 917-889-3093. And a lot of people seek mental health, and they're not really sure where to go or how to go about it or what they really need. They just know that they need to reach out to someone.
And there are a couple of different levels of care, which we will be discussing. The first and primary level of care, which both Mr. Bell and myself practice, is outpatient mental health. And that's pretty much the basic level, outpatient mental health.
And that's kind of where you go to an office, sit with a counselor, therapist, and explore what's going on with you.
Yes, but at that level, and so traditionally, it's been you call in, you speak with receptionist, therapist, you get an appointment, and you would come to their office for the therapeutic experience or the therapy session. Usually lasts about an hour, 50 minutes to an hour. And initially, when you come in, the therapist is going to do an assessment to just get the information and try to develop goals and things to work on during the duration of therapy.
And some of those things that the therapist might ask during the initial assessment, besides the basics like married, single, children, what else are some things that the therapist looks for in the initial assessment?
Well, the therapist might want to definitely know those questions you asked, but they would also be exploring your current past mental health experience. Have you ever been to a therapist? Have you ever experienced counseling? Things about where you went to school, things about the type of classes that you took in school or the type of setting that you were in. Was it a regular setting? Was it a smaller setting? Did you take advanced classes? Behavioral issues, if any, while you were in school?
What's some of the differences between if I bring, say, my teenage child in for therapy, what's the difference in the assessment process for the teenage child as opposed to the adult? Is there a difference in how the assessment works?
I would still be interested in knowing about where that adult went to school, but I probably would focus more so on independent things to do with the adult. I probably wouldn't ask about, I might want to know if you're still in touch with your parents if you're an adult, but I wouldn't need their information unless you saw it as someone I need to contact. And with a kid, I'm going to focus more of the attention on behaviors, any type of mental illness in the family, and definitely connecting more with the parent to get their views on what's going on to better help them and direct them. But with an adult, of course, you're at the age where I don't need your parents' information unless you feel that it's valid and I would need it. And I would probably focus more on how you see things or those individuals. It could be a friend. It could be a spouse or a paramour or a loved one that you feel is significant for me to talk to.
And I think also, you know, obtaining the information from an adult, the adult hopefully will be a little more forthcoming because a lot of times if you take your child to therapy, sometimes the child doesn't really want to be there and it's like pulling teeth. But the adults, when they come in for therapy, going through the assessment process, it's been my experience that they are really looking for help. They want some guidance. They want to let you know what's going on so that you can help them. I think that's the important thing about the intake assessment. It allows the therapist to form a plan of what they want to do with the client. So, yeah, I want to remind you guys we're taking calls tonight, 917-889-3093. And also when the child comes in for the assessment, it's important as well to explore their interactions with peers, how they interact with kids at school, in the neighborhood, in the community.
I often ask my clients if they're young, you know, who's your best friend? Tell me their name. And they look at me kind of astonished at first, like, you want me to tell you their name? And it's not because I'm going to contact them or anything, but I want to connect. I want them to say their first name just so I can get an idea. And how did you meet this individual? How significant is this individual for you and why? So I'll kind of explore those things. But definitely we look at friendships, connections, extended family members, aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters. We look at that dynamic as well.
And also with the adults, you look at dynamics as well of people that they interact with day to day throughout the week, the community involvement, and also peer relationships at work for adults are pretty important as well, because a lot of people who work, they spend a lot of time at work, and how they interact with those peers is very important as well. So all that is vital information for the initial assessment, okay? So moving on from the initial assessment, I think it's important the therapist will formulate a treatment plan.
And on the treatment plan, what we do is try to decipher by asking questions on, I might ask a question, a probing question on, by the end of therapy, what will be different about you? And what do you want to work on? And what areas are most important? Or sometimes they might be unsure, so I might say, what do other people of significance, think you need to work on? And try to gauge with numbers where you are with your anger on an anger scale from 1 to 10, the depression scale, just to get where they would rate, or if they're not sure, where others would rate them, and the desired number that they want.
And therein lies the purpose of the treatment plan, because the treatment plan is kind of like the roadmap to the therapy, because your treatment plan should kind of explain what your goals are. And when it comes to setting goals, I think it's important those goals need to be formulated by the client more so than the therapist.
A lot of times it's difficult also. I can't speak for Earl, but for myself it's difficult because we get a lot of clients who they want to be here, but they might not know exactly what they need to work on. So you have that tendency to want to try to help and try to point them into the direction. But therapy is most powerful and helpful if the client can identify and give you those numbers and give you those areas of that they need to work on.
Yeah, and I think you're right. A lot of times there are clients who come in without any direction as to what they need to work on. And a lot of times, from what I've seen, those clients just feel like everything's going wrong and they can't really pinpoint anything specific. So it's like, where do I start? And I think it's like you say, if you allow the client the time to identify like what their numbers are as far as depression or kids, how bad their anger is, then it allows them to start pointing out what they really need to work on.
Right. So we kind of try to open that, and not to plant thoughts or words in their mind, but to open their mind to kind of explore what they want. And a big thing that I tell them, I usually do the scale when I do it. I'm sure other therapists do it differently, but I do it from 1 to 10, 10 being the most, I would say, worst or the most problematic issue, and 1 being the best, the desired issue. But I often stress to my clients, you're very, very seldomly a 1, and you're very, very seldomly a 10. You can use numbers in between. But even when they want to set goals to that, I don't discourage them. I just let them know that's kind of hard to meet and maintain over time. So that's kind of how I do it.
And I think the thing that's important, and we'll use like your scale as an example, the 1 to 10, you want to have, in a situation like that, more or less than, say, 5 days than more than 5 days. Like, if you have someone who comes in and says most of their days are 10, and then after therapy a while, they come in and they say, well, most of my days are now 6, that's improvement. And it's like you say, it's important for them to be aware. We may never get to a 1, but that's okay, because going from a 10 to a 6 is improvement.
It's significant
improvement. Significant, definitely.
And usually, like Earl just said, he said, you might not ever get to a 1, or it can be those, that scale can be extreme. What I usually say to them is, in general, people never, you know, you're not going to hit that, but, oh, I know, where are you at usually? Not where are you at right now, but usually, what number are you usually at? So I kind of give them that leeway to pick, because a lot of times when we ask that question, they think, how am I feeling now? And I want them to know, no, in general, where are you at usually?
Right. And the thing about it as well, going back to the scale, you're right. An individual might not be at 1, but they might hit a 1 time.
Absolutely.
And then bounce back up to a 2, 3, or 4 or whatever. And, you know, that's not to discourage the client from reaching for the 1, because they might hit a 1. But you have to, again, be realistic, like you say, that you're not going to be at a 1 all the time. You know,
I usually ask them questions when they say they're a 3 or a 4. Have you ever been a 1? And when you were that, what was going on with you? What
right.
kind of, you know, experiences were you having at that time? Or even a 10, the worst of the worst of the worst. What was going on with you?
And so as they move through therapy, they talk about their feelings and their scales, and then they move toward discharge. How long do you feel like therapy usually lasts with a client? What is a good time frame for the client to get better? Just in general, I know you can't speak to all clients and everything's just kind of in your opinion. So what are some time frames that you feel like a client should be in therapy?
That's a good question, and I think it differs from client to client, absolutely. But our job, I feel, is to empower the client, to give them the tools, to help them develop the tools and the coping skills to handle whatever comes their way. And so we help them through that, but we don't want to enable them to depend on us to fix everything. So we really want to empower them to come up with the solutions, come up with the answers, and how to fix it. As far as time limit or time restraints, I would say individual therapy, you should be reviewing those treatment plans, I would say monthly, just to see where you are. But definitely by the third month, you should be revamping or redeveloping where you're saying we need to continue this goal, client hasn't met this goal, or client is meeting this goal, not quite there yet, or client has met this goal. And by 6 months, there should be either new goals or those goals should be closed out.
I think that's important what you said about new goals, because like over 6 months, we might work through and resolve a client's depression, but then during that time, something could have popped up where they're having anxiety as well, to where that we're, after those 6 months, the depression might be under control, where the client feels like they're in good shape, but their anxiety might be a little bit more prevalent. And at that point, yeah, you would start addressing the anxiety as well. Not saying that you couldn't address the anxiety and depression together, but if you're working on the depression because the client hadn't really experienced the anxiety or verbalized the anxiety, but now they are because the depression's under control and they realize, hey, something else is going on, then, yeah, you're right. It's important to start working on the anxiety as well.
And that often occurs because if you're treating a client for depression, depression and anxiety can go hand in hand. So if you're treating a client for depression, that symptom might improve and decrease, but it can manifest in other areas. So the goal might change and shift to us focusing on the anxiety, or they're not as depressed, but they're not getting out as much. They're more fearful about interacting with others. So that's a reason to definitely continue, but with a new goal and with a new focus on how to help the client again to cope and deal with day-to-day issues.
And I think it's important also to think about, you know, as the client moves through therapy, as they start to improve, it might not be necessary to meet with the client weekly. You could maybe drop back to twice a month and then slowly step back, because you make a great point. As a therapist, you don't want the client to become dependent upon the therapist.
I think it's easy also. I like that you said that. I think it's important that you said that, because I think it's easy for clients to look at us as the fixers, and the job is to enable them, to encourage them, to give them the tools to fix, to empower them to know they fix, and to not give them anything, but to help them explore and come up with those remedies themselves. So I think that it's important for us to ask those questions, help them to explore, but give them an opportunity to try out those coping skills, strategies, and if they fall, let them know it's okay. It's not catastrophic. You can recover. We're always here, but you need to be able to test these skills that we've explored with you.
And there's an expression as well, the client's 10th best solution for their problem is better than the first best solution.
Absolutely.
Of the therapist. So, yeah. And so now that we talked about outpatient therapy, going to the office to see a therapist, I want to say, you know, give us a call. Our number is 917-889-3093, and we will be back in a second.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your host, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
Okay, so we're back now, and we've talked about individual therapy as far as like going to an office to meet with a therapist. But what if the client's issues and things that are going on with them rise to the level or that, you know, a therapist sitting in an office is not able to meet the needs? What's the next level that they could seek out?
Well, at that point, we can definitely make an assessment and make a referral. That referral probably would be to one of the facilities here that provides other levels of care. We can refer them to the emergency room, especially if they're a danger to themselves and others. That's not a question. That's the first place they need to go. And if they call and they don't get someone, you need to call 911. You need to go to the emergency room immediately, because any emergency room will get an assessor there to do the assessment and make that recommendation.
But if the client is not necessarily at the level of care for outpatient therapy, then they could also seek out intensive outpatient therapy, which is a step above outpatient therapy with a therapist.
Absolutely. And I suggested going to the emergency room, but if you're with the therapist in an outpatient private practice setting, and we can make that assessment, make that referral, and get you in where you can have that assessment done, you would need to go to one of the locations here where they can do the assessment. We can also give our referral and give them the information about what you're going through. The next level up, I think it's intensive outpatient.
Exactly. Totally. Yeah. And the thing about the intensive outpatient, it's just what the word says, just what the name says. It's intensive. Therefore, it's more therapy and more driven than just 1 hour a week with the therapist. So basically, intensive outpatient is you go to a facility, like you said, like usually it's 3-4 times a week for only about 3 hours a day. Okay. What exactly can you help us understand happens with those 3 hours?
Well, let me say this, and I will get right on that. But I wanted to say this with the private practice, the outpatient therapy that we talked about previously, it's usually 1 hour a week. And I told you all, we told you all, it's usually in the office, but there are different levels of that as well. You can have in-home therapy, and it can go a little bit longer than 1 hour, But usually it's no more than hour and a half to 2 hours. So if it goes beyond that, you're looking at the intensive outpatient. And with the intensive outpatient, as Earl said, it's going to be 3 to 4 days a week, about 3 hours a day. You're going to have group therapy. You're going to have individual therapy. It's going to be pretty intense because it's going to be daily.
And one thing also about the intensive outpatient, besides the group therapy and the individual therapy, there are also staff within the facility, within the program, who can kind of check in with you and just touch base with you and kind of see where you are. What are you feeling? What are you thinking? What's going on? How are we doing as far as the therapy that you're getting here? What can we do for you while you're here? So those are all things that happen with intensive outpatient as well. I do want to give out our number one more time, 917-889-3093. Give us a call if you'd like to speak or have questions about this subject. So we're talking about the intensive outpatient program.
And with the intensive outpatient, as what's different from the intensive outpatient than the outpatient that we provide is you might have a group in outpatient, but it's going to be once a week again. The intensive outpatient probably is going to be every day. In addition to that individual, you're going to get that one-on-one with the therapist, but you're also going to be in a group focusing on the issues that are pertinent to what you're going through. So that's going to be pretty regularly, daily, probably an hour, hour and a half, and it's going to be more intense.
And the good thing about the intensive outpatient program, it provides a buffer between needing to go in the hospital where you're severe, chronic severe depression, suicidal, those kind of things, and you're able to go home. That's the important thing with IOP as well to remember is you're going there for just a few hours a day to get, like we say, the intensive therapy, but then you're able to return to your home. It's not like you have to stay at the hospital. A lot of people have this thought that once you go to the hospital, you have to be there and you're going to be there. They're going to keep me. I hear that a whole lot.
Yeah. And with that intensive outpatient, Earl had spoke about the other people that are involved. A lot of times there are mental health techs who are going to check in with you, but they're also going to provide something called psychoeducation, which is a support in itself, just giving you information about different ways to deal with, but just information that's helpful to you about day-to-day supports and periodicals that you can read and check into that help you to give you enlighten you. It's not therapy, but they have that resource. You have nurses, you have a host of people checking in on you and supporting you through this process.
And also the psychoeducational part, basically it's what the name says as well. It's educational. The text, like you say, will provide you with periodicals and things you can read. They will also maybe teach different classes on symptoms of depression, you know, but not getting into what's driving your depression and those kind of things. That's left for the therapist. More of, like you say, just kind of giving the information regarding mental health and regarding different
Absolutely.
Issues within mental health
Absolutely.
As well. So, yeah.
And from there, from the intensive outpatient, there's a step above if you need to go. And just so you all know, Mr. Bell and myself have worked in all these settings. The next step up would be the partial hospitalization.
Yeah. And it's what the name says, partial hospitalization. You're at the hospital for partial time, which is more than the 3 hours of the intensive patient program.
Right.
And I didn't mean to cut you off. What are some of the signs and symptoms that might require a step up from intensive outpatient to the partial hospitalization program?
I would say that you are decompensating a little bit more, not to the level of inpatient, which we're going to talk about that as well, but the 3 hours that you get from a therapist, a licensed clinician, the support from the mental health techs and the nurses, you're not getting what you will get from partial, because once you go into partial, you're going to get a psychiatrist, you're going to get a trained medical doctor to evaluate, collaborate with the therapist and the nurses. In the intensive, the nurses will check on you But to some extent, I would say, Earl might disagree, that their hands are tied. They can make the referral for the partial, but in intensive, there's no medication or no area of expertise in that unless you go up a step. So with that partial, you're going to get a psychiatrist, you're going to get a licensed therapist, you're going to get a nurse at the registered nurse level, BSN or higher, you're going to get the psychoeducation. It's just a step up, and you're going to get more time. So you're not going to be there only 3 hours.
Right. And during that time, the psychiatrist can, you know, evaluate for possible medication or tweak your medications that you might be taking as well. Because that's one thing that's really important is with the medications that they be monitored, especially if you're starting on a new medication. And the partial hospitalization allows that. The psychiatrist will see you 3 to 4 times a week. And that way, if they start you on a new medication on Monday, they can come back, say, on Wednesday and check in and see how you're doing with the medication. And if it needs to be tweaked a little bit, they can tweak it. And then again, they'll see you a third time during the week as well. Also, you mentioned the group therapy. How is the group therapy different from the intensive outpatient, or is it any different?
I would say the difference is, and again, I haven't worked inpatient, intensive outpatient, partial for quite some time, but if I recall correctly, the difference is when you're an intensive outpatient, you got that licensed therapist clinician there, but they're more so for the individual work with you. Maybe you're getting more so of a mental health tech, not a grade down. They are very trained and very capable, but they're probably running your groups. They're more psychoeducational. Once you go into partial, you're going to get that licensed clinician also in that group. So they're going to be doing more psychotherapy in the group.
And also with the partial, it's 5 days a week most of the time, whereas
that's
the IOP
too.
Is
that's
only
true.
Three.
Right. That's very important. 5 days a week. Psychiatrist there daily, evaluating what's working with the meds, checking with the nurses, seeing what the families are saying, the parents are saying, if you're a child, but just checking in more thoroughly on tweaks and things they need to take care of.
Right. And I think the thing about that as well is because step up from IOP, it's done because your symptoms have gotten a little more severe, as you said.
I would agree.
And that way, that allows a little more monitoring of those symptoms, you know, as far as the week goes, because 3 hours a day for 3 days or 4 days a week with intensive outpatient, you might not see something, whereas over a 5 day week, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours in the program, the nurse, the psychiatrist, or the techs even may see something within you that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely. And the partial, I would say, my previous experience with partial, is it can go anywhere from a couple of weeks to, I'd say, a month to 3 months. Usually not 3 months now. It's usually a month or two. But you usually get a good month or two, and it's every day. For young people, not the adults, but for young people with partial, you also get school. So if you're in a partial program and it's during the school year, most of them, I can't speak for all, but most of them have the school system in the program where you get the school for a couple of hours, because a lot of these youth have problems at school. So that's a reason for them to be referred to the partial. So they still get the educational piece, but they also get the intensive mental health piece as well.
And I think that's something to be aware of as well. As an adult, if you go into the partial program, you probably will have to take some time off, FMLA time or something like that, because the partial program for adults runs through the day. And if you have a day job like the majority of people, then you're going to have to work with your employer, your HR, or whomever to get that time off for your treatment. We'll be right back.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your host, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
And we're back. And after the partial program level of care, the next step up would be to actual inpatient treatment. And there's certain criteria an individual has to meet to be put inpatient. But before we get to that, can you kind of explain, Benny, what is inpatient therapy? If I'm going inpatient, what will the experience be with be for me from the jump, from the start?
Yes, sir. A lot of people are fearful of inpatient therapy. They see it as very restrictive. They see it as very demoralizing, or it's the bottom of the barrel, per se. This is my area, besides the private practice, the outpatient therapy that I'm currently doing, that I would say I'm most attuned to, or I know the most about, because I worked inpatient a long, long time. I think it's a very good program. I think it is for those individuals who are feeling unsafe.
Or even demonstrated unsafe behaviors.
Demonstrating unsafe behaviors. Maybe they're right. Maybe they're not voicing that they're unsafe, but the behaviors are voicing that they're unsafe in so many ways, or showing that they're unsafe. So they could be psychotic and not know. There are a host of different things. A lot of people, however, get upset because they're so quick to take their loved ones to be assessed, and they think they're automatically going to be admitted inpatient, and it's not that easy. It's not that way.
Right, and that's where the criteria, like you say, comes in, because you can't just take your wife or husband in to have them admitted because you're mad at them.
Absolutely.
The individual has to be displaying, first of all, danger to self or others, or also severely, like you say, experiencing psychotic behaviors to where that they can't care for themselves and can't function day to day, hour to hour, in that manner.
And that has to be present, because a lot of times family members, parents, loved ones, spouses, they might even genuinely feel this, that they're unsafe, but the clinician, the assessor, is going to listen to the family member, the loved one, but they're also going to talk directly to that individual, and they're going to assess for psychosis, and they're going to assess for suicidal ideation and homicidal ideation, and they're going to ultimately make that judgment call. And if those individuals are coherent and lucid and able to respond not only accordingly, but with thought and emotion and logic and reason, even more than emotion. They know that, yes, I'm depressed, and I know I said these things, but yes. So we're looking for all kinds of things. And so I don't want anyone to think this process is easy, but it is a necessary process that a lot of families need. And if you are truly concerned, I encourage you to go there and do what you need to do.
But the thing that's really important is, again, we're talking about inpatient and what it is. And what happens is, you said earlier, a lot of families feel like it, or a lot of people, that it's restrictive. It is restrictive, but
It's
restrictive to be safe,
right,
in a safe manner. Because it's not like a jail where they lock in your rooms or anything like that. The thing about inpatient care is you're monitored constantly. You're actually locked in the building. You can't leave the building. And you're monitored 24/7. There's a nurse or staff on site, on the unit, watching you. Plus, along with a psychiatrist who will come in and evaluate you for medications as well. And I think the important thing about that as well is their goal is to make sure you're safe. Bottom line, that's the ultimate goal.
And that restriction is there for a reason, as Earl said. However, if you are the person, or your loved one is the person, is in that setting and they are displaying control, logic, and reason, they will be treated accordingly. And they will be monitored, but they won't be, the horrors are, I'm going to be strapped to a bed. I'm not going to be able to leave my room. I'm going to have to wear some type of gown or something, you know, restrictive, and that fear. Or there are going to be lots and lots and lots of people who are attacking me or trying to hurt me. I've worked in that setting for several years. That has not been my experience. There are those situations, but they usually people that come are scared. They're fearful.
You're right. And I think the thing as well, and you mentioned earlier as well, that some people feel like it's, you know, demoralizing, dehumanizing. And that's the thing that goes along with the stigma with mental health. That's why going inpatient is really, and it should be looked at as a strength that you are going in to get the care and help you need.
Absolutely.
Because again, I go back to talking about inpatient care. The goal is to get you back to where you can step back down, maybe to a lower level of care, like the partial or intensive outpatient of which we spoke. But the important thing is your safety is paramount. That comes first.
I agree.
One thing also I want to touch on about the inpatient care as well is being put in a hospital against your will. A lot of times if you are a danger to yourself, but you won't voluntarily be admitted in some states and they can pursue court ordered treatment to where that you are kept in for up to 72 hours against your will. And that's probably a good topic for another show. So, you know, I think we can move on now, and we will be back in just a minute.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your host, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
And we're back, and we're going to talk now about a different type of care. I don't know if it would be considered a level of care, kind of like substance abuse treatment, which is available through outpatient or inpatient. And I think if we touch a little bit on both of them, we can kind of draw a picture of what substance abuse treatment looks like. And substance abuse treatment, it gets all kinds of different bad raps, but I think the main goal is for the individual to go in, learn their triggers to their use, and learn ways to live without the substance.
Yeah. And I know in the outpatient, we have a lot of clients referred. If you are seeing a doctor, a psychiatrist, if you're going to a clinic to deal with your substances with a medical physician, they usually have to and will refer you to a therapist for continuity of care.
Well, and also that goes along with, you know, to stop using substances.
Absolutely.
It takes more than just a medication,
absolutely,
a pill or something like
absolutely
that. You have to change your lifestyle. And that's the thing about, you know, chemical dependency, substance abuse treatment. A lot of people call it rehab. So when you go to rehab, a lot of times you will have a doctor who will monitor you and also a therapist who will work with you and usually a substance abuse counselor as well. And I know the big thing was 28 days, the 28-day program. Any more for an actual in-house treatment program, a lot of times it doesn't last 28 days. Sometimes it might really based on your issues and your addiction and what the payer source is willing to pay. Unfortunately, that's a fact of life. So yeah, I wanted to touch on that a little bit, but now can we move on to residential treatment?
Yes, absolutely. And
are we looking at mostly, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I was going to say for residential treatment, I don't know if it would be considered a level of care. However, it is often utilized, and a lot of families, especially in the outpatient realm, contact us and they want residential. For their kids.
Yeah, most of the time residential is for children.
Absolutely. They feel like, well, they've been to this place, they've been to that place, it hasn't helped them. They are really becoming accustomed to it and used to it, and I think it's hurting worse. We want them in a residential. Residential is, I consider, or many people consider it a group home setting, wouldn't you say?
That's what I was going to ask. It's different than inpatient because it's not really in a hospital. Some of the residential facilities do have locked doors, and the kids, since we're talking about kids, aren't allowed to go outside till they reach a certain level of behavior on their treatment.
Right.
And I think that's the thing as well. I think the good thing about residential, as you put it, is it's in the community. Usually it's a community-based type group home or different little houses, cottages within the program. And it also allows for the kids to get out in the community as well.
I think it's a very good resource for many families who have had their kids in these different mental health settings for more of a long-term strategy and support. It does integrate the kids into society with that structure, with that much-needed structure. Some of the kids go to school on the campus, but a lot of the kids get to go to their regular schools, and those residential settings will allow either transport the kids to their regular school, or the bus. They can go right to the bus stop and catch the bus and go to their regular school. So it's a very good setting for them to feel integrated and a part of.
And I think the important thing as well, and you touched on it, is that the residential, the group home setting, it's for the longer term treatment, but not for the chronic type, you know, depression or suicidal ideations. Obviously, that would be back to the inpatient level of care. And so the residential is more for a long-term type behavioral modification program, more so than dealing with the suicidal ideations or depression.
If you have someone who's in a residential setting who is having major depression, active or chronic, and is still going on, or anxiety, or any of the severe mental illnesses that are treated, they're going to be probably referred back to an inpatient setting. Because the residential setting only occurs when the hospital feels that they're stable enough.
Yeah, you're right. And that's one thing. Most residential settings that I'm aware of will allow a step down from a hospital. There are very few that the parent can call up and say, my child's acting up here at home. Can we bring them in? There are some, but not very many.
Right.
Most of them, you're correct. It goes from usually it's a child who's been in and out of the inpatient hospital setting and
return home.
And they return home. They come back to inpatient, return home. And the treatment team and the doctor and the family even feel like, well, this time we can't send them home, but we can't keep them here for inpatient.
Right.
So that's where the residential setting is kind of a go-between, so to speak.
I think it's powerful, the residential setting, because of the structure, because of the number of staff. They have psychiatrists usually or nurse practitioners trained in mental health. They definitely have therapists and clinicians that are licensed. They definitely have the mental health techs. And it's very, very structured. That's the most important thing. The hospital is structured, but it's more of an intensive, we've got to deal with the symptomatology that we're seeing.
Right.
Whereas the residential, they are stable, but they don't want to send them back home because they failed at home when they return.
Right. And the thing about going to the residential from the hospital, you make a great point, is it's a step down because they've gotten better, but they're still not at a point where they can go home and be successful. And again, with the kids or with any patient at the hospital or in any setting, the ultimate goal is for the client, the patient, to be successful as they move forward.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in residential, they have them in all the cities, all around the country. So we want you to know that is an option, but usually to go in that setting, I know at least for Louisville, Kentucky, I don't want to say the requirement, but that's one of the things that that's one of the areas where they believe the powers that be that you need to have tried inpatient and been bumped down to go back home, and it's not been successful for you. And after a couple of those times, and the parent on board, parent has to be on board, you know, let's try this. They come home, they've not been successful, we tried what you told us to try, and it's still not working. We think they need more structure that we can provide, because, you know, it structure is very important, and they will get that in that setting.
Right, and so I hope that kind of opens your eyes a little bit to the different levels of care. And it's real important to consider what you need, and if you're going through something, to reach out to whomever, and hopefully they can help you and point you in the right direction.
And I wanted to say one other thing, Earl, because we've covered pretty much all of the levels of care. We even talked about residential setting. I have a lot of parents who ask about boot camp.
Boot camp. Boot camp to me is, it's an overused term. You know, I think the phrase boot camp implies that the kids are in a military type setting, digging hose, throwing in hose. In fact, there was a movie called Hose where these kids were in a boot camp and they were digging hose. And then they fill the hose back in with dirt. But anyway, I think a lot of times boot camp is overused when realistically what they're looking for is a residential setting,
okay,
like we discussed earlier. Sometimes there will be some juvenile detention facilities that function as boot camps where it's, to me, a boot camp is more of a step away from jail or even a jail type setting for the juvenile or adolescent.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. The only area I disagree is the level of structure. That's what I would say. Because I even think in the residential setting, as compared to the boot camp, there's just a lot of structure. And that in itself is very powerful and very, I would say, life-changing if the kids can stick it out and get through it. That structure is very imperative.
But the boot camps, most of the time, from my experience, they are more of a court-ordered juvenile justice type setting instead of the parents saying, hey, I want my kid to go here to get help. So, yeah. So we hope you enjoyed our episode tonight. And if you want to listen to it again, it is available for download. But please be sure and listen to us next week and phone a friend, phone your neighbor, and let them know we are here.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your host, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.